The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.
Football Weekly today full of FA Cup magic. At Wembley, Villa have a web scandal that doesn't involve Ashley Young and a laptop, while Portsmouth overcome Spurs to make the final. Says Harry Redknapp, "I haven't lost a semi this dramatically since I saw Ian Dowie in the shower." Pod marvels at the Pompey triumph and asks, is it just us, or is that Wembley pitch not very good? Elsewhere, Valencia misses a sitter as United stay on course to end season with a whimper. Plus, stunner at the KC as Hull fought the laws, and the laws won. Abroad, we've got good news for the people who clean fountains in Madrid as Barca win the Clásico, whilst in Italy it's Claudio with a chance of Scudetto as Ranieri's Roma go top of the table. All of that, plus your post in today's Football Weekly. And hello. Welcome indeed to Barry Glendening.
Hi, James.
Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
And Owen Gibson.
Hello there.
Hi there, Owen. So much to discuss today. Let's begin with that fairy tale story. Sunday afternoon at Wembley, Pompey overcoming injuries, bankruptcy, and a half naked man continually ringing a bell to make a May mauling by Chelsea in the final their destiny.
Yes.
Yes. How did it happen?
There was an element of luck, and that Spurs were totally dominant throughout the 90 minutes, but just couldn't score. Portsmouth performed heroically to repel them and then got the upper hand in extra time on the back of a slip by Michael Dawson in the penalty area, which I believe you think...
If that slip had been performed by a Chievo defender... I know what we'd all be saying about it. I wasn't so alarmed by the fact that he slipped, which was obviously par for the course on this Wembley pitch, but by the fact that whilst halfway down on one knee, he elected rather than struggle to his feet and try and contrast the opposing player who had the ball in the penalty area, on one knee he decided to just lie down and roll away from the whole kind of football business.
Also, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was extraordinary, and I have no idea why he lay down in that fashion.
They were aided also by the now traditional Wembley refereeing snap, yes. It, of course. You know, that was definitely a goal, wasn't it?
Yeah. And also the penalty that wasn't given when David James embraced whichever lucky Spurs player who was making his way with ball to... It was all rather extraordinary, but well done to Portsmouth. Fairy tale stuff. Quote Avram Grant here, "To see the fans and the players so happy, for these moments you work all your life," he said. "To see the members of staff who have been sacked in the dressing room with us afterwards, it's very humbling." Or is it?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, like, Simon Burnton was doing the minute-by-minute on the game, and he sort of wrote at the end, he sort of finished it and said, you know, this feels like a fairy tale, but... And obviously, the case you make, or you could make, is, well, if the fact that they've had to go into administration proves that they were effectively cheating, they were spending above their means, then... They were cheating as much in the FA Cup as they were cheating in the Premier League. It's difficult. You tend to think, and certainly, you know, my gut reaction when looking at it was to think of it more from just the players' point of view. And there are a lot of players there who, you know, haven't done anything wrong themselves. They've accepted the money that was offered to them, and a lot of them have now basically agreed not to have certain payments that they were due so that they could continue playing because there were clauses. There was a report that came out just before the semi-final saying that there were six players who might never be able to play for Portsmouth again if they played in the semi-final because of the clauses in their contract that would mean automatic bonuses or automatic contract renewal. So they've obviously all had to, some of them anyway, I don't know if it's all been resolved, but some of them have certainly agreed to waive those fees. So from that point of view, and also from the point of view of Avram Grant, who is rapidly becoming that, you know, another one of those managers who you just have to sort of root for it a little bit. I mean, you think of the jip he's taken off people like us, and there he is still standing and still, you know, getting a team that's ultimately still not that talented, regardless of whether they've cheated, because you see how they've done in the league, even without the points deduction, to the final of a cup.
I think can now inhale, I think, probably.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
I think you can feel really pleased for quite an extraordinary group of fans without sort of that taking away from the fact that you can still be concerned about how they got here. And I think one of the concerns is that if the fairy tale, in inverted commas, somehow glosses over the mistakes that were made and the sort of rank bad management that got them here, that would certainly be a mistake.
Well, plenty of people...
It's easy to see the point that they shouldn't even be allowed to be in the FA Cup anymore at this season, but the fact of the matter is that most of the players they overspent on were on the Spurs team yesterday. And the manager who did most of the overspending was managing Spurs yesterday. And this result need not be necessarily bad for Spurs either, because now they're out of the cup, they can concentrate on trying not to drop out of the Europa League places in the Premier League.
Well, it is true, because, you know, we've talked about their slump and we've been called out by this Spurs fans.
Who's going to take them out of the Europa League places, though? Liverpool are single-handedly doing their best not to.
Well, they have a tough run of games coming up, do they not, Spurs? They have Arsenal midweek and Chelsea, both at home, of course, and then they're away to Man United, who might still be in the title race at that point. What of Portsmouth?
Sorry, you were saying there that Spurs fans are calling us out on what? Well, being correctly... assessing the fact
I
that
I think there was a feeling that we were delighted at forecasting and then revelling in a Spurs late season slump. But
well, I am revelling in it up to a point, in that you had to listen to smug Spurs fans earlier this season saying, oh, this will be our year, we'll finish fourth, blah, blah, blah. And as sure as eggs is eggs, they have.
Were they? Were they saying this will be our year?
Well, then why are they so uppity now that we're revelling in their utterly predictable slump?
Right.
I'd say a slump which I suspect will get a lot worse before it gets better.
So you think it's they're on the downward slope?
They seem to be back where they were at this point last season to me. I mean, it seems like, you know, again, they've sort of flattered to deceive, and again, they haven't quite taken the step up, have they? You know?
No. Far be it from me to chip in and throw my hat in on Spurs' side, but I think Harry Redknapp did say the other day, and I tend to agree with him a little bit, you look at where how their last season was, and this is a significant improvement, even if they don't win the rest of their games now, because they had a pretty rough season last year. I think that given how Liverpool have done, and given that the race for fourth hasn't been all that, I think that there was an opportunity which they haven't necessarily taken. It doesn't look like they're going to take, because I think City will now finish out fourth, but you know they still can. And actually,
it's slightly smack of getting the excuses in early, doesn't it, to say before your FA Cup semi-final and the run-in today, as this will have been a good season regardless. You know?
Yeah. Portsmouth, meantime, facing, of course, Chelsea in the final, in which, again, they'll have various players which Ravram Grant says he can't pick, probably, unless they, you know, renegotiate, etc., etc., etc. They, as a finalist, normally would get a place in the Europa League, Chelsea, you know, already being through to the Champions League. A lot of a lot's been made of the fact that they won't because they didn't apply for a UEFA licence, etc. But that's not over yet, is it?
Well, as things stand, they wouldn't be allowed to compete in the Europa League because they're in administration and they fall foul of UEFA's sort of financial controls rules. But the window is still open in which they could apply. So if they exit administration in time, they still have a matter of weeks in which they could do that. I mean, I think from speaking to people at Portsmouth, though, it seems unlikely that that's going to happen in time for them to do so, but it's still a possibility.
Well, Avram Grant was saying that he hopes very much they'll be in Europe next season, but there's no imminent deal to take them out of administration.
No, the administrator, Andrew Andonoku, is still pursuing sort of a twin-track approach of talking to this secret millionaire consortium fronted by this guy Rob Lloyd, who's yet to reveal where his money's coming from, which, you know, that always rings alarm bells, the term mystery backer. So there's those talks going on, while at the same time he's trying to agree a CVA with Balram Chanrai, who was their existing owner, who took them into administration, and that still rumbles on in the background while the players caper on the Wembley turf.
Now, a lot's been made about the Wembley pitch and its inadequacy to grace our national football stadium. Top grounds person Barry Glendenning now reports on what the problem is and what prospects there are for a decent bit of turf at Wembley.
The prospects are bleak.
Are they?
Yes. The Wembley spent, I don't know, 750, 800 million on the stadium, and their very last consideration appears to have been the pitch, which is very much substandard. It's slippery, players can't keep their balance on it, even though you think some of them are taking dives to lose on purpose. It's been blamed for several high-profile injuries to Wayne Rooney and Michael Owen, among others. And the problem is that pitch, say, at the Emirates and other stadia in the Premier League is a Deso stadium, or pitch, I think it's called, and it has...
Doesn't that mean it's got fibres mixed in with the grass to make it tougher?
That's correct.
Oh, right.
And it's seeded, whereas the pitch at Wembley isn't, and it's sort of very boggy and soft. It doesn't get any exposure to sunlight or the wind, so it doesn't that doesn't help. If it rains, the water remains on top. It holds the water like a sponge. And they need this at Wembley so they can... If they were to put down a pitch like they have at the Emirates, it would take 3 months to bed in, and they would need as that's the kind of pitch that can't be moved in and out of the stadium to facilitate rock concerts or monster truck driving or rally races or whatever, then it can't be used at Wembley. And between now and the end of October, I think there's two rugby matches, seven football matches, three concerts, Green Day and Muse, if anyone's interested.
Oh.
Yeah, Green Day and Muse by two. And a Muse gig would literally frighten the grass at Wembley, you know.
Right.
And an American football game to be staged between now and the end of October. And there could be other stuff too. So they don't really have... it's difficult to see how they're going to improve it.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, you mentioned the cost of the stadium, which is famously £757 million. And they and the two things aren't unrelated, because obviously the reason they need to put on all these various events, from monster truck driving to Muse, is to pay off the loans they took out to build the stadium in the first place. So that's another reason why they couldn't afford a 3 month holiday to grow a better pitch. So it really is a sort of catch 22.
Wow, and the Champions League finals at Wembley next year.
That's right,
and there's no prospect of things being resolved then, or.
Well, it's hard to, as Barry says, it's hard to see how they would, because they've got this calendar of events. And I was in seeing the guys who run the Wembley Stadium arm of the FA a couple of months ago, and they were full of all these grand plans about extra events they were going to try and squeeze in, and events that would attract, you know, if you only use the lower half of the bowl and you attract 30,000 people rather than 80,000 and all the rest of it. So they're really sort of, if anything, they're ramping up the number of events they're trying to squeeze in, which, again...
So FA Cup semi-finals, there's ones for the 30,000 fans, were they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There were empty seats on Saturday, actually, wasn't it?
I did notice that there is a 2 month window at the moment between Green Day and the Challenge Cup final, in which would that give them time to have a proper pitch in, or does it have to be one that can be moved in and out?
I think it has to be one that can be moved in and out purely to facilitate the concert.
They had a lot of problems at the Arsenal about concerts at the Emirates. I was going to say on that pitch. So obviously the concerts wouldn't necessarily be a problem.
But it's the number of concerts. Though. I mean, you're right. Arsenal had Springsteen last summer and one or two others, but literally a handful compared to the sort of 30, 40 events that Wembley looked to have in a year.
Right. This conversation is quite literally as exciting as talking about grass
growth. I was just going to mention that, of course, they had major problems along these lines. After Italian 90, when they built up a lot of the Italian stadiums and created microclimates therein, which prevented the grass ever really taking root. And San Siro, probably the worst. There was that famous plan, you'll recall, in the 90s, where Milan wanted to put the entire pitch on hydraulic jacks and lift it in between matches up to roof level. Good. So that's enough, you know, turf talk, is it? Yeah? OK, the other semi-final, quickly, before we round off part one, Chelsea-Villa. The John Terry Challenge?
Well, that was contentious as well. Again, players slipping and sliding all over the place. I don't think John Terry, we can blame the pitch for his atrocious tackle on James Milner. He should have been sent off.
Paolo's frowning as only Paolo can.
No, it was just when you started saying slipping and sliding, I thought for a second there you were going to let him off for that, because that was a knee-high challenge. It was absolutely outrageous. I really thought that was a, you know, terrible challenge, and the sort of thing that actually I think the FA should pick up on after games, because that genuinely, when you have managers, you know, like Arsene Wenger always talking about dangerous challenges, a lot of them aren't necessarily, but that really is a dangerous challenge to go that high.
Mm. One thing I would say is I think a lot of people, and you know, we've given John Terry a hard time in here, but I think because of his previous in the field of bedroom antics and whatnot, he's getting, you know, a particularly hard time over that. It was a bad challenge. He should have been sent off, but there's no need to call for his head in a spike. One thing that really did annoy me about it was that when he was booked for it, he was actually complaining, as in, what did I do? What did I do?
Yeah.
You know, it, just take the card and be grateful you only got a yellow.
I think that's probably true, but also he's probably had years and years of getting away with things purely because he is England's John Terry and, you know, brave and committed and all the rest of it. And he probably does get away with slightly more aggressive tackling than some other players might.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that incident, I think Deco could have been sent off as well, because they played the advantage. Deco promptly went in with a second bookable offence, and I think he got away with it.
Petrov.
So we could have had the spectacle of two Chelsea players being sent off at the same time, with 15 minutes to go.
There's no doubt that O'Neill, I mean, you know, kind of obviously O'Neill grumbled afterwards, but in this case, he had every right.
Mm. Well, a great weekend, of course, for Chelsea, because, well, they were in action in the FA Cup, beating Villa. United, possibly their main title rivals, had that 0-0 at Blackburn, and Sir Alex making all sorts of comments about it slipped away, the title's kind of gone. Bit surprising, really, to hear him talk in those terms, although Chelsea, of course, do have that home match against Bolton coming up on Tuesday, in which you would expect them to extend their lead.
Well, you would, and it's amazing how quickly things have turned around. It was after a draw at Blackburn, of course, that everyone was writing Chelsea off. So, you know, I think it's not over yet, but if you're right, it was jarred a little to hear Ferguson talking like that, because you wouldn't normally expect him to apparently run up the right flag at this stage. And I wondered what his game was, perhaps.
I would normally expect any team managed by Sam Allardyce to run up the white flag when they're taking on Manchester United at this stage of the season. So it was nice to see that they didn't. But United were terrible, and, you know, without Rooney, they can't score goals.
Well, you say that Spurs' season could get worse, so United's as well. They have City, who are in rampant form, as we'll possibly be discussing later. They have City up on the weekend. Radicus Finch wants to know what the sources were for the piece in The Observer, I believe, saying that United, or was it The Guardian, saying that United have turned down the chance to sign David Villa because he costs too much of the Glazers' pocket money. But maybe I'll sit about that, since I'm getting blank looks here. When we dial up the man in Madrid for a chat on all things Spanish, and especially El Clasico, right after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Hello.
Hello, Sid. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Very well. You were at the Bernabeu, were you, on Saturday?
I was indeed, yeah.
What do you reckon?
Well, there's so many places to kind of grab it.
The all right.
I mean, there's so many plots and subplots. But the first thing I'd say is that I didn't think it was a particularly great match. It had been built up as, you know, the game of the millennium and a game that was really going to be just huge in every way. And, of course, it had all the ingredients to be that, in that, you know, you've got Messi against Ronaldo, you've got Madrid against the Barcelona, head-to-head at the top of the table. It seemed like no one could beat them. But it was a bit flat, but the result has led to all sorts of different areas of debate. And I thought it was a very interesting game in terms of the way that Barcelona approached it, and ultimately in terms of the way that they controlled it. And in that sense, the player that I think really shone more than anyone else was Xavi Hernandez.
And not for the first time. Yeah, it was a curious build-up with Dani Alves playing, sort of leading the line. Exactly.
Yeah, and that's one of the other subplots, because we were in a situation in which Zlatan Ibrahimovic wasn't fit. So Pep Guardiola had a series of options, and one of the options he had, and the one he went for in the end, was to have Alves as part of a line of three up front. Now, one of the reasons why that's significant, first of all, is because it failed. And in the second half, he admitted that, Guardiola, by putting Alves back to right back, because Alves just doesn't function unless he's kind of arriving by surprise from deeper. And the other thing I think that says is sadly for Thierry Henry, his time is up. Because if in a situation in which Ibrahimovic isn't available, for Thierry Henry not to get anywhere near the pitch, I think is really striking. It also points at something else, and this is one area in which I'd be tempted to give Guardiola the benefit of the doubt and say that while it looked like it didn't work because Alves didn't play very well and because he wasn't really involved in the game as a striking player, it does say something about the fact that Guardiola was genuinely concerned about Madrid. And I think putting Alves on the right-hand side with another back behind him was also a way of trying to counteract what he assumed would be Cristiano Ronaldo bombing at them on the left-hand side and Marcelo bombing at them on the left-hand side. And in that sense, it sort of worked. Guardiola was very, very obsessed with preventing Madrid from having easy counter-attacks. And Barcelona almost played with no strikers at all in the first half.
A bit humiliating for Real Madrid, though, that Barcelona's lineup not really working in the first half, and yet they were still happily taking the lead at the Bernabeu.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that has been picked up on, is that this wasn't the 6-2 of last year. It wasn't humiliating in that sense, but there's almost a feeling that maybe it was slightly worse, because it felt like Barcelona won without really having to try that hard. It kind of felt like, well, we'll ride out the storm and then we'll come back and we'll pick you off a couple of times and that will be it. It felt like Barcelona maybe had a bit left in the tank. Now, I think that feeling is ever so slightly false, because for 25 minutes or so, Barcelona were very uncomfortable. I thought they really struggled to get out from the back. But I actually think Madrid were victims of their own approach. They were so determined to kind of screeching to challenges, to hammer Barcelona hard, to do everything at 100 miles an hour very, very quickly to stop Barcelona settling, that kind of pressure that they put on Barcelona ultimately ended up being a pressure that they put on themselves, because the kind of the over the over hasty approach, the accelerated approach that they had in terms of getting a ball from Barcelona and putting pressure on Barcelona, meant that when they got the ball, they played in exactly the same way, and they were hideously imprecise, and they were kind of shooting wildly very early. They weren't clever with possession, Madrid, and I think it was seven, maybe eight shots on Victor Valdes's goal. And Valdes made seven or eight saves, but I would say that only one of them was any good. All of them were really quite easy.
What's the reaction been in the Spanish press, Sid?
Well, there's been all sorts of different kind of threads to it. The key one, as you could probably imagine, is a sense of, if you like, a kind of judgment on Messi against Ronaldo. And I think that very obviously comes down on Messi's side. But what's interesting about it is that there's actually been some criticism of Ronaldo, probably for the first time this season. Some Madrid fans whistled him. There was a feeling that he was trying to win the game all on his own. But then that's the way he plays. And it's worked very well for Madrid for a lot of this season. And there's been a few comments in the Madrid press about Ronaldo needing to be taught a little bit what Real Madrid is all about, and it's not all about him, which I think maybe is a little bit harsh, but certainly it's true that that's the nature of his game. The other thing that, as you can probably imagine, has really occupied the Madrid press is what happens now. Pellegrini to go, without any doubt. Who do we sign now? Who do we buy now? And I love this idea of let's go and sign more players, because it's worked so well up till now.
Sid, on an unrelated note, I want curly hair too, post in, say, does Sid know if there's any truth in reports in the Mirror that Man United have lined up David Villa and Karim Benzema for the summer, with Berbatov, Carrick and Anderson leaving to make room for the two mentioned above, plus Milner? Another story was that United had balked at the asking price for Villa, in further proof that they really don't have a pot to piddle in. Do you know where the truth lies, Sid?
Well, could I first of all start by putting my hand in the fire, as the phrase goes, for the Guardian newspaper? One of those stories is from the Mirror. One of those stories is from the Guardian. Who do we believe?
Mirror.
Oh, Christ, that silence wasn't good, was it?
Barry Danny said the Mirror.
Danny Taylor wrote in The Guardian that Manchester United have balked at the possibility of signing David Villa for the amount of money that Valencia want. It is true, certainly. I just don't know about the situation from Manchester United, but it is true, certainly from Valencia's point of view, that they want Villa to go this summer. Villa has finally been persuaded that he doesn't necessarily need to go to Madrid or Barcelona and would like to go to England. Manchester United is an option that does appeal to him. And so in that sense, I think that's absolutely credible. The situation with Karim Benzema is that Benzema himself is saying that he wants to stay at Real Madrid and succeed. Florentino Perez, the president, who of course is the key to everything that Real Madrid do, doesn't want to lose face and lose Karim Benzema just yet. Of course, if he has to, then he will do. But I think the feeling is that Madrid, at very least, would like Benzema to have another season to try and prove that he's quite good.
Mm.
Because this season he hasn't been, to be fair to him, partly through injury.
Right. Sid, on a final note, it says the goal of the season was scored at the weekend, and it wasn't
Messi. Yeah.
Well, who was it?
Brilliant. Really good goal, yeah. It's Javi Martinez from Athletic Bilbao who scored a fantastic goal that was actually quite Messi-esque, and he's in the penalty surrounded by three players. He does this little drag back, drops his shoulder and goes through a gap that doesn't even seem to be there. I urge you to look it up on YouTube. It's Javi Martinez against Almeria, and it's a brilliant goal, and it may well be the best goal of the season, yeah.
Wow. Well, producer Ben will no doubt include that in the little preamble at the top of the Football Weekly page, which you should visit, listeners, if you don't usually. There's a chance there to comment and earn the disdain of Barry Glendinning and others and engage in healthy debate, the like of which indeed.
Did you
brought
say healthy?
Yeah, because
yeah,
well, you
I
mentioned
think,
that.
I think there's anything but healthy.
No, there's plenty of interesting stuff there, and I read it religiously.
Yeah, you just have to sift through the shit, don't you?
No, there's plenty of good stuff. That Daily Mail headline that you mentioned, that was posted up there.
Oh, very good. Excellent.
Yeah.
So does that I don't need to include it in my column today because everybody already knows it?
Well, the happy
few. You kind of ruined
few.
My column for me.
Cross-promotion, says Ben. No, the happy few who enjoy our message boards, and they are very enjoyable. There's a lot of very amusing stuff in there.
Very few.
Yeah. They will have seen it, but I'm sure they'll be delighted to be reminded about it by your venerable self. You know, I said on a final note, but I've just thought of something else I wanted to ask you, and it is this. Fulham are playing Hamburg. Liverpool have Atletico Madrid. What are their chances, Liverpool, against Atletico Madrid in the Europa League semis?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think the fact that Atletico Madrid are in the semi-final of the Europa League and that they're in the final of the Spanish Copa del Rey is, and I have absolutely nothing against Atletico Madrid, absolutely scandalous. They have been mostly an appalling team this season, although they have a couple of very, very good players indeed. Forlan is finding his form, and I think there's no doubt that Sergio Aguero is a really fantastic footballer. But they've been basically dreadful this year, and the fact that they could win a cup double is just bizarre. You look at their record in Europe this season, in Europe, in all European competition, because bear in mind that they were in the Champions League and they got knocked out of that. They've won one European game, and they're in the semi-finals. In the Copa del Rey, they've managed to beat, congratulations, Atletico Madrid. I think it's Marbella, Racing and Recreativo de Huelva. I mean, this is not so much a march to the final as a drunken stagger that somehow they managed to find their way home and not lose the keys. It's absolutely incredible.
Let's see, who knows about Dutch football, Owen? Do you know about Dutch football?
I'm right. An authority on the subject.
You're an authority on everything, Barry Glendinning.
Gardening.
Gardening. Other stuff?
Other stuff.
Yep, okay.
Dutch football. I know that FC Twente are about to win the Dutch league, barring a Devin Locke-esque collapse.
Formica Atomica says Ajax second in the Eredivisie, having a goal difference of 77, having scored 96 goals. That's plus 77. What the hell is Steve McLaren doing that his team are ahead of that machine? Well, very impressive for 20. Something pretty good. And what's the latest on McLaren? Because I'm sure there are lots of moves to bring him back to Blighty, Nespa.
I haven't heard that there are any moves,
no?
But I presume he does appear to have rehabilitated himself. And I'm sure any English team would be glad to have him.
Do you think when he comes back to England, he'll have to fake a hilarious English accent to get back on side with the local
Poor
fans?
Chap. He's never going to forget that, is he? One ill-advised interview and... Yeah,
I can see what he was trying to do in that interview. I think.
Do you think he was trying to do something, or was he just caught out? He'd become.
I think he was trying to speak in the simplest possible terms to an interviewer whose first language wasn't English.
Mm.
He was making an effort, and it sort of went wrong.
You can say that about much of his English career as well.
Well, yeah. But he seems like a nice chap.
Is there a possibility he's happy where he is and would be happy to stay put? I don't know. I haven't read any interviews with him or anything recently. So
you would imagine the lure of the Premier League and the chance to prove the English media wrong, etc. would.
All right.
I don't know why everyone's so obsessed with proving the media wrong. We're more than capable of proving ourselves wrong time after
daily
time.
Basis, yeah.
I mentioned the Europa League and the Liverpool and Fulham success. They're in straight after all the dramatic exits from the Champions League. Avid fan posting in saying, I remember last year when we had three teams through in the semi-finals of the Champions League, and everyone was saying, but the Premier League's not actually that good because we're not getting anywhere in the Europa League. Now it's the other way around. Should we therefore give the Premier League some credit?
No.
No? All right. Okay. Meerkat.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that obviously Fulham are getting a lot of credit, rightly so, for reaching it, whereas Liverpool, it does feel like a consolation prize, even if they win it.
Le Gaffe, as a United fan, I was told that we scored too early away in Germany and it was difficult to defend that lead, referring to the Bayern Munich game. Fulham scored even earlier than us and they seemed to cope fine against the German champions. Viva Hodgson, the man is brilliant. Sorry, Pally, you were going to talk about...
No, all I was going to say is I think people really need to get over this obsession with deriving which league is better than another one from a knockout competition. I just think it's a bit silly.
But, all right. Yeah. Like
can't we just say that certain teams are better than other teams rather than...
Right, let's do that then.
It's like Sky's
Ross County is better than Celtic. Can we say that?
Yes. Okay. Definitely on the strength of...
Cable 1973, Ross County beating Celtic 2-0 in the Scottish Cup. What an incredible result. Wonder what Robbie Keane thinks.
Well, his face was a picture as he trudged off at the end of the game. I don't think he'd bargained for that kind of humiliation when he went up to Scotland.
On the bright side, at least he's not missing out on an FA Cup final.
every cloud. Celtic were a disgrace. They were totally outplayed by a team from the Highlands who play in the First Division. And Neil Lennon, after the game, he said he wasn't even... I think he'd gone well beyond anger.
Yeah.
And accepted that it might damage his chances of getting the job full time, and said that if he wasn't at Celtic next season, the one thing was certain was plenty of the players wouldn't be there either.
In other news, Meerkat United FC says it's that time of year again when awards are handed out. Who are the posters and pod pundits thinking of for their individual awards? He suggests most improved player of the season should go to Bobby Zamora, who, of course, played a big part in Fulham's win there at Wolfsburg.
He could also get the gong for biggest baby of the season for the
spat with the man.
Spat with the Fulham fans.
Yeah. Dummy throwing antics, yeah. Yeah. Florent Malouda, maybe, most improved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good. Somebody was tweeting in for some League One talk. I managed to delete their name by accident, with Norwich racing away and an exciting race for second, etc., etc. I believe that Norwich's favourite son, Paul McInnes, might be joining us next Monday. So perhaps that would be an opportune time for that.
Isn't Alan Partridge Norwich's favourite son, with McInnes trailing in a close second?
Well, it depends who you talk to, I suspect. West Brom are up, though. That's confirmed now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, then.
They're from the Championship.
Exactly.
Not League One.
No, I know.
All right.
Right.
Did you know?
Yeah, I did know that.
Did you know, or are you just furiously backpedalling because you just realised you've made a terrible mistake?
I know that West Brom are up in other relegation promotion news. And, of course, relegation and promotion is something they're extremely familiar with because that's the seventh change of division that they've had in the last nine seasons.
I thought it was interesting to see the sort of jubilation of the West Brom fans despite the fact that every year they either go up or are relegated. It doesn't seem to, doesn't seem to change the fact that they're either distraught or delighted by turn. You
know? Right.
I'm pleased for Roberto Di Matteo, though. I'm sure you are as well because he seems like a good guy and he's a very good manager.
Right. I've no idea how his chip shop chain is doing, though, because he had that was one thing he diversified into in his wilderness years outside of the game. He had a chain of chip shops.
All right, because there's a chain of chip shops in Ireland called McCarry's.
That's not there.
No, but I thought that might be Lou McCarry might have done the same thing.
Well, Lou McCarry famously has the fish and chip shop outside Old Trafford, no?
Does he?
Yeah, very famously, yeah. In other chip shop news, right, okay, no, that's it for part two, I suspect, with an exciting instalment of Serie A talk coming up in only a matter of seconds. Okay, Serie A, huge a weekend. Roma have gone top. First time they've been alone on top at this point in the season, etc., since last time they won the title, 2001.
And the first time that any team has been top other than Inter after the 11th game of the season since 2006. So it's, it is genuinely...
It's big.
It's a little bit exciting for those of us who follow Serie A that we finally have an actual title race rather than the title chase, which is what we've had the last few seasons, which, Inter get in front early and they stay in front the whole way. And, you just wait and sort of see how close it'll be by the end of the season. And this season we actually now have someone else ahead of them for the first time, certainly since Jose Mourinho's been there, but since, since Calciopoli, the Inter players actually have to deal with being behind in the lower part of the season, whereas I have to deal with Baz trying to take photos through a strange lens.
He's just picked up a spare piece of electronica and he's waving it. Thing is, what is the thing? What were we just talking about?
We were just talking about
Inter. You know, I have to keep myself amused during the Serie A section.
Right.
But I mean, it was basically what happened was Inter drew 2 all the way at Fiorentina on the Saturday. They had gone 1-0 down, then they come back and Milito scored, Eto scored the 2-1 up. They'd actually always won up to that point when Milito and Eto both scored. And this is with less than 10 minutes to go and you think, okay, they're going to preserve it and there goes that chance for another weekend. But Fiorentina scored again a minute later. There was, some suspicion. It wasn't a blatant one by any stretch. There's some suspicion that Kroldrup may have been offside on that goal, which was helped none by the fact that Mourinho afterwards spotted the linesman Airoldi, who, since we were riffing on Howard Webb, English World Cup representative, I'm pretty sure Airoldi is going to be one of the Italian officials at the World Cup, was seen with clenched fists saying, let's go, and looking like he was celebrating. So Mourinho tried to go and speak to him. Obviously, Mourinho isn't speaking to the Italian press except at Champions League games at the moment. So the Inter sporting director, Branca, came out afterwards and said, let's hope it's not because he's a Roma fan. Let's hope it's because he was pleased with his decisions. But, it doesn't look great, obviously. It's happened in England before. I can't remember the referee, but there was once someone scored a goal.
Giancarlo Alberti, the head of the FA, I believe, or the Italian FA, I believe I'm right in saying, says his version of the story is that at the end of the game, the referee, was it Taliavento? No, Paolo, was it Taliavento? He was in the Genoa derby.
Yeah, it wasn't Taliavento, was it? I can't remember.
Anyway, the referee basically went on the mic to say to everybody, well done, it was a really big game, and we got through it, well done to everybody concerned. proud to work with you or whatever. And at that point, Eraldi went, yes, good one, or whatever.
And to be honest with you, as I say, that these things happen, and there was certainly a situation in England where I can't remember what the referee was, but he, I think it was a Liverpool game where a goal was scored because of an advantage, and he celebrated there on the pitch, and there was some controversy after that. It happens, and the referees are entitled to think they've done a good job. And actually, what's interesting about it is that all week everyone was saying Fiorentina are going to blow this game on purpose, and so that, and then Inter will blow the
copy. Why was that? Why would
because Fiorentina, debatably, I mean, I think they'd still say they have a chance of getting European places, but arguably Fiorentina's league season is over. They're playing Inter in the cup on Tuesday in the semi-final, and there's the conspiracy theorists were mooting that Fiorentina would roll over on the weekend and then Inter would roll over in midweek, which obviously now won't happen. So anyway, Inter drew
like Michael Dawson there in the box at Wembley. Yeah,
your allegation, James, nothing to do with
I'm
me.
I'm just saying
when
that
the
I
Dawson
don't
lawyers.
I don't understand.
Into
they can explain why
HQ.
When Michael Dawson went down on one knee, instead of getting back up to his feet, he decided to pause and then roll all the way down. If you look at the replays, you'll see, as I did, that it's a very curious thing for a footballer to do. Why that would be, I don't know. Obviously, the Wembley pitch. But anyway, in Rome, the big thing is it's not going to happen, the Scudetto. But if it did...
Yeah, that's like a banner that they've all got up at the moment, saying basically exactly that. And then, of course, they were playing Atalanta on Sunday, which is a day later. They knew they were 2 points behind, so they could go top. And, you know, Atalanta, I think, third from bottom at the moment. They're, you know, not having a great season, but they had won, I think, three of their last four. They've been on a little bit of a run. You know, it wasn't going to be an easy game, but Ranieri pulled a surprise by dropping Toni, which no one expected him to do. He started with Totti up front, and they scored twice early. And the first goal, admittedly, if you want to, you know, keep looking for trouble, there was an absolute howler by the keeper who basically let Vucinic's shot squeeze through his fingers when it was straight at him. They went 2-0 up at half-time, let one in the second half. It wasn't a convincing performance by any stretch, but to be honest, Roma have rarely been especially convincing during this run, but they're now 23 games unbeaten.
23 games unbeaten. Crikey, they have the derby next weekend, but then Inter have Fiorentina, first of all, in the cup, and then Juventus on Friday. That's going to be interesting, plus the spectre of another federal inquiry into those tapes, which will get on to when somebody actually publishes some proper evidence as opposed to just allegations.
One other slightly interesting side that came out on Samuel Eto'o during the week, which was that basically he is trying to claim that he's owed some money by Barcelona from the deal that took him to Inter. Now, Barcelona's lawyers have come out and said, you're not owed any money because it was only ever a loan deal. Now, the reasoning behind this seems to be that the deal was set up such that he had 1 year left on his contract at Barcelona, so Barcelona loan him to Inter for a year, and then it automatically becomes some sort of permanent transfer immediately afterwards. But nevertheless, if he's actually technically only on Inter at loan, you know, that may have some implications that, I don't know, could not yet have been worked out. I don't know, especially if he's now going to contest it and say, well, if that's the case, I'm not happy with it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see some light shed on that and the many other issues surrounding Inter and this year's title challenge. Now, in England, meantime, there's a small but select series of fixtures awaiting us on Tuesday and Wednesday, possibly the most eye-catching ones of which are Spurs at home to Arsenal. We kind of talked about Spurs before, but Paolo, do you regard Arsenal's... has it slipped from their grasp, the title race, the way it has from United?
I just don't know if I see. I think Chelsea have suddenly got a bit between their teeth again. And for them to drop four points, which effectively will have to happen because Arsenal are 3 points behind, but Chelsea have got a goal difference that's vastly better. I think it's quite unlikely.
Right. Wigan, meantime, are hosting Portsmouth. Wigan now in the thick of the relegation battle. Portsmouth no longer in the thick of the relegation battle. And this following Burnley's astonishing victory there at the KC Stadium against Hull.
As soon as you saw Ian Dowie all over the press, sort of talking up his training methods and all the rest of it, you probably knew that Hull were going to get tonked by
Burnley. What was special about his training?
Well, it was just the fact that he was very much. He's always quotable at the best of times, but he was you know, interviews all week, sort of, you know, sort of saying how he was going to turn things around for Hull, and they got absolutely taken to pieces by Burnley, and those and two extraordinary penalties. I mean, I think there was probably a lot of Sunday League Park players up and down the land trying to spoon them into the top corner of the outside of their foot and failing on Sunday. But Hull are obviously in it, and Wigan now dragged back into it after West Ham's result as well. I think it's hard to look beyond those bottom three as they stand, you know.
I don't think there will be a relegation battle because I think the bottom three will go down.
Right.
Burnley were abysmal against Hull and still managed to win 4-1.
Arguably played as badly as they did against Man City the week before.
Yeah, God, it was terrible. Like, to borrow an analogy from Eamon Dunphy, like watching two drunks swinging at each other in an alley. But they're both awful, and I would can't see either of them staying up.
Hmm. Well, well done to Burnley, and nice to see all their players stayed at the stadium instead of going to a local hostelry in this match. In the meantime, Man City destroyed Birmingham, who don't lose many in this manner, do they, Birmingham? No, they don't.
No, they've had a great, I mean, they've had a great season, Birmingham, and yeah, you're right. It was unusual to see them ship so many goals, but Man City now look nailed on for that fourth spot.
What's happened to Man City? Because it seemed a bit tentative under Mancini in the early games, but now they're really...
Well, it feels like they've clicked his place, and also feels like they're slightly out of the spotlight. There's been a run of sort of big Champions League games and big sort of flashes at the top of the table, and it feels like they've been sort of, you know, able to click into gear, if you like. And if it had happened a bit earlier, it'd be interesting to see what would have happened to the title race.
Has it been a lot to do with players coming back from injury and the like?
Yeah, I think that's an element of it, and also probably Mancini finding his feet a little bit. You know, but he did have an easy run of games to start with, as was much commented upon at the time. But it's always going to take time, isn't it, for a manager to start stamping his authority on a team. And I think, you know, he's probably bought himself a lot of time and probably a lot of money to spend in the summer with this sort of late run.
His 11 goals they scored in the last two games. Ever since, really, he took on David Moyes for that ball, for that throw-in. I wonder if that just
could have been
fired up the team, you know. I'm sure as a player, when you see your supposedly effete Italian-style monogram shirt, scarf twirling manager
strapping
actually
awkwardly for the ball
with scary David Moyes, I bet you think, well, get in, or whatever, you know.
It'd be like if we saw you tussling with Marcotti or someone.
Yeah, I'm game.
Did you see, actually, that Marcotti said on the BBC website if he could poach one person from Football Weekly, it'd be me.
It'd be you, Barry.
Or Wilson, the
or
pyramid
Jonathan
inverter.
Wilson, yeah. I did see that, actually.
Were you slightly jealous?
Very, very bitter. Yeah. It's always been my dream to join.
I'm not going anywhere, don't you worry about that.
All right, then.
Unless the price is right.
Yeah. Anyway.
David Villa of the Port.
Indeed so.
I wish.
On that note of relief, that's where we come to the end of today's Football Weekly. We made it, listeners. We made it. Many thanks to producer Ben, and best wishes to his sick cat, which he's off to pick up as soon as he gets this wrapped up. And in the thanks as well to Barry Glendinning.
I thought we'd established his cat wasn't actually sick.
She is. He's pretty just... sick. She's got cat AIDS. How sick do you want her to be? She's on a diet of peas. That's not health.
I think she's just mollycoddled. Right. That's what it sounds like to me.
All right.
In my considered opinion, right, as someone who
well,
was
a
vet.
Son of a vet. Yeah. Okay. Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
And to you too. And Owen Gibson. Many thanks for joining us today. We'll be back on Thursday. If you can bear it, we'll speak to them.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.